And I always react very negatively to that term, crowdsourcing. I think that crowdsourcing, when organizations or companies think in terms of crowdsourcing, they're really missing the point of what's going on. They're really misunderstanding a lot. The idea of crowdsourcing, the term, of course, comes from the term outsourcing. And the idea of outsourcing is you're in a high labor country and you're trying to have a business there. And you realize you can hire workers more cheaply in a different country, so you outsource the jobs there. And then crowdsourcing is the cheapest thing of all. You somehow trick the general public into doing your work for you for free. If that's your perspective, you're going to do a lot of things wrong. You're going to really misunderstand what's going on online. It's as if you decided to open up a bowling alley and you thought to yourself, well, we've got all this bowling that needs doing, and so our job is to trick the public into bowling for us. That's completely wrong. That is not what you're trying to do. What you're trying to do is provide people with a platform or an experience that allows them to accomplish what they want to accomplish as individuals, in concert with other people. And it's that focus on the real and genuine interests and needs of the person who may be contributing to a project that really makes all the difference in the world. If you think about why do people contribute to Wikipedia or what do the contributions look like, they are not crowdsourcing. They're individual, passionate people. We'll meet some of them later on in the lecture tonight who really care about getting it right, who really care about things. And so every single word in Wikipedia was written by an individual. They wrote it in concert with others, in dialogue with others, in conversation with others. But it always comes back to that, individual people thinking about what should be done here, what's the right thing to do, what do I think should be done. So Wikipedia, of course, began with a very radical idea. And that idea is for all of us to imagine a world in which every single person on the planet is given free access to the sum of all human knowledge. That's what we're doing at Wikipedia. Now, this is a very big and bold goal. It's one that's really energized a lot of people. It seems very, very exciting. For me, when I first had the concept, it suddenly seemed like, wow, this is what the internet is for. We built this great tool. Most people, when they first saw the internet, they thought, it's amazing tool for sharing knowledge around the world. And I thought, in the era of the dot-com boom, when the internet seemed to be mainly about selling dog food and other such nonsense and all the crazy things that were tried then, I said, why don't we just use the internet for sharing knowledge? That's what it seems to be about. So that's what we started to do. So what is Wikipedia? One of the things I love to do is to say, how many people here have used Wikipedia? All right. This must be a college campus. It is actually very, very interesting. This is, of course, the typical reaction, but the next question is really the interesting one. How many people here have actually edited Wikipedia? So that's pretty good. That's like 40% maybe. And that, again, is quite typical of a college campus. It depends on where I am, who I ask. It varies with different audiences. But in general, I find that, university campuses, a lot of people have edited Wikipedia in some capacity, whereas the older the audience gets, perhaps the less likely they have edited, or the less technically oriented an audience gets, the less likely that they've edited. So for the people who have not edited Wikipedia, but have just used it, so you type something in a search engine and you come to Wikipedia, you may not have all of the ideas behind Wikipedia and what it's really all about. So when I ask what is Wikipedia, it's important to think about all of the pieces of the puzzle. So Wikipedia, of course, is an encyclopedia, but the full definition of Wikipedia is that Wikipedia is a freely licensed encyclopedia written by thousands of volunteers in many languages. So when I say free access to the sum of all human knowledge or freely licensed, what do I mean by that? Well, what I'm really talking about there is something very special. We come from the world of free software, open source software, as many people know it. And in that world, there's an old joke that we're talking about free as in speech, not free as in beer. So free beer is great. Somebody gives you free beer, you drink it. That's really wonderful. But we're talking about something more fundamental, the freedom of speech. So everything in Wikipedia is placed under a free license, meaning that you're allowed to copy it, to modify it, to redistribute it, to redistribute modified versions. And you can do all of those things commercially or non-commercially. So this is a really powerful concept. And certainly from the beginning days of Wikipedia, This was really surprising to a lot of people. Back in 2001, people thought the way to have a really popular website is to have unique content that nobody else has, and you know, you put a fence around it and make sure nobody copies it, and then people will come to see your unique content. And we took the opposite approach and said, well, actually take our content, copy it, modify it, do anything you want with it. That's perfectly fine with us. And that drove an enormous amount. Oh, wow, look, you can see the slides now. Drove an enormous amount of adoption as people would copy it. People felt comfortable quoting from it and so on and so forth. And it became obviously incredibly popular. Another piece of that vision statement is the sum of all human knowledge. What do I mean by the sum of all human knowledge? Well, what that means is that Wikipedia is a very specific type of reference work. Wikipedia is an encyclopedia. So Wikipedia is not a dictionary. Wikipedia is not a textbook. Wikipedia is not an archive. Wikipedia is not YouTube. So I love a funny cat video as much as anybody. My daughter is 11. She's always sending me great funny stuff from YouTube. But that stuff does not belong in Wikipedia. One of the things that's been really powerful for our community and our ability to get our work done is that we do have a clear understanding that Wikipedia is meant to be an encyclopedia. And so we may have debates on the borderline about should this be in Wikipedia or not, but the overall framework we have is one of mutual understanding. So if I say Wikipedia entry about the Eiffel Tower, everybody in this room has more or less the same idea of what that should be. We may quibble over the details, and believe me, the Wikipedians do quibble over the details endlessly, but in general, you know what it's going to look like. It's going to tell when it was built, why it was built, where it was built, who is the architect. Should have a couple of pictures. What was the cultural reaction? What has been its impact on culture since? All of those things belong in an encyclopedia entry. What does not belong in an encyclopedia entry? Well, we typically won't have a list of the 10 best restaurants nearby. That is a travel guide. Nothing wrong with a travel guide, but that's not what Wikipedia is. So there's a lot of that kind of thing where, because everybody has a shared understanding of what an encyclopedia is, it makes it easier for people to collaborate. It makes it easy to work on it. We know where we're going, so we know a little bit about the steps that we need to take to get there. So we've got this huge community all around the world. We've been working in Wikipedia for now 11, almost 12 years. And we've got over 20 million articles, nearly 4 million in English, across 270 different languages. Now, this question of how many languages Wikipedia has is a tricky one. I quote this number 270, but I think that number is actually a little bit optimistic. That number includes languages where the interface has been translated, but there are almost no articles. It includes languages where there are only 50 or 100 articles. So the number I prefer is about 200. There's about 200 languages that have at least 1,000 articles. And so that 1,000 articles is a very small encyclopedia, but that's normally a size where there's an active community and people are coming together. They're starting to think about how to promote Wikipedia in their language, how to find other people to help them write it. And so 200 languages, so that's an awful lot. But this is not distributed evenly around the world. English Wikipedia is the largest, with about 4 million articles. We've got German, French, and Dutch each have over 1 million. Somebody told me the other day another language has gone over 1 million. I forget which one it was. Then we've got several other languages that are above 500,000. Basically, we're really strong in all of the European languages, including English. We're very strong in Japanese and in Chinese, and I'll talk about Chinese in a minute. But beyond that, it does tend to taper off quite a bit. There are a lot of languages that have very small Wikipedias. And the factors that lead to that are pretty much what you'd expect. It has to do with broadband internet access. It has to do with literacy rates. One that's a little bit surprising is that, as I can tell, one of the big factors is weather. So, for example, the Swedish Wikipedia is really, really big compared to, say, the Italian by the number of speakers because it's really, really cold in Sweden. And in the winter, there's nothing else to do but sit at home and write Wikipedia articles. And the Italians go out strolling and having gelato. And we do see, though, I mean, it's a good joke, but we do see the northern European countries have very, very big Wikipedia, very strong communities, and they're very, very active. And there's a lot of different reasons for that. I mean, it is a joke to say it's the weather, but there are other factors involved that are quite interesting. So All around the world, Wikipedia is typically in the top 5 or top 10 of all websites. One of the languages that people are always interested in learning more about is Chinese, because quite famously, China practices quite extensive internet censorship, and so people say, have you ever had troubles in China, and so forth? And the answer is yes, we've had a lot of trouble in China. Wikipedia was completely banned in China for about 3 years. We have now been open in China for just over 4 years because just before the Beijing Olympics, the Chinese took, they opened up quite a bit. They unblocked the BBC, they unblocked Wikipedia, but they didn't completely unblock. They still filter certain pages, and the pages that they filter are exactly the ones you would expect. There's hot button issues in China. So Liu Xiaobo, the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize for his democracy activism in China, Ai Weiwei, the artist, who's always annoying the Chinese government. I don't know if you saw his video. He did a fabulous video the other day, which was immediately blocked in China. He did it only to annoy people, and it was the most annoying song in the history of the planet, Gangnam Style, which he did a version of. That as far as I could tell, there was nothing explicitly political about it, but he just did it to sort of thumb his nose at the authorities. That's blocked in China, his entry, and other serious things. But the interesting thing is, we took a stand a long time ago. When we were blocked in China, we made the decision that we would never compromise. So we would not go into China and participate in the censorship. My view is that access to fundamental information, access to knowledge, is a fundamental human right. It's a corollary of the right of freedom of expression. The freedom of expression means nothing if you don't have the right to read and learn so that you can express yourself. Yay. Come on. You agree with me. So when Google went into China, Google, for a while, they decided to participate in the censorship regime, and I was very critical of that. I'm happy to report now that Google, of course, a couple of years ago, I guess it's been, has pulled out of China. They decided they can no longer cooperate, and that was a really great move on their part. So I'm really happy about that, but we've always held very firm on this. As a result, although we're number 5 or number 10, in that range in every other country around the world, in China, the popularity of Wikipedia, we're about the number 50 website in China. So whenever I've gone twice to see the minister of the State Council Information Office, and he's been twice to America to see me. When I spoke to him about this, because I like to have a little bit of fun, I said to him, oh, it's a shame that China is so far behind in Wikipedia. He thought I was going to say Wikipedia is behind in China. So he caught the twinkle in my eye and thought that was a bit amusing. But he said, well, you're number 50. There's over 2 million websites in China, so that's not so bad. Yeah, okay. So it's interesting, and China is one of the few places where I've spoken to an audience of college students and asked how many have used Wikipedia, and only about half the audience raised a hand. That's how many have used Wikipedia, not how many have edited. Anywhere else in the world, particularly with the college demographic, it's 100%, like all 100% of all college students have used Wikipedia. And so there was a really funny thing. It was only about 2 years ago, some Canadian university did a survey asking students which websites they had used, and 90% had used Wikipedia. So the reporter from the school newspaper called and said, well, does it surprise you that it's so high? And I said, who are the other 10%? Aren't they going to flunk out of school? I don't really understand, How could you? I never heard of such a thing. So I said, you have a lot of students who've just come from China. That might explain it. I don't know. They haven't heard about it yet. So, in any event, we're now broadly available in China. They filter certain pages. And so the interesting thing is, although we're not as popular in China as we are in many other places, we have had a bit of a cultural impact in China. Somebody sent me this image. This is from a restaurant in Beijing. Oh, come on. A clicker. Clicker, clicker. You're not going to get to have the entertainment of me wandering around stage. Okay, the clicker's broken. I have to stand here. Okay. From Beijing. This is a menu. Wikipedia fried with eggs. Here's another one. beef brisket and Wikipedia flavor. People started sending me this. Somebody sent me this and they said, Jimmy, what does this mean? And I said, I have no idea. But I know who will know. I knew we have a very active community in Beijing and Shanghai. So I emailed the Beijing area Wikipedians and I said, what does this mean? And they wrote me back. A couple days later, they had to deliberate and ask around. And they wrote me back and they said, we have no idea. Got the Wikipedia bread company. It's like a Starbucks, you know. It's a nice, they have a nice bread. I ate there. Stir-fried Wikipedia, I mean, it's quite a lot. So the only thing that we figured out, and a lot of these are quite different food items. This is not just one thing that happens to sound like Wikipedia in Chinese or something like that. It's many different things. And the only thing that we figured out is that around the time of the Olympics, this is when these started happening, the restaurants, a lot of local restaurants in Beijing knew that the millions of foreigners were coming for the Olympics, and they were going to translate their menu for the first time ever. And they may not have such good English skills, and so they went online. And, of course, you type in any food item, and what's the first thing you find? Wikipedia. So, that, you know, how do you say this type of mushroom in English? Wikipedia. Okay. I like it spicy myself, pimentos. So, as you know, we're a charity. We have absolutely no sensible business model whatsoever. But I think I finally figured out a way for Wikipedia to make some money, which is I think we should open a restaurant chain in China. So, well, this is all very fun, but it does raise the very interesting question that lots of people, this is really a health hazard. A lot of people are very interested in, which is how does the content compare across different languages? Wikipedia, of course, sometimes people ask me, how many languages is Wikipedia translated into? And I say, no, translated into, you've got the wrong idea. It's mainly English speakers who say this because native English speakers tend to be quite poor at other languages because even if you travel a lot, English is the easiest language globally. And so we're quite lazy. We don't learn other languages very much. And so there's a natural tendency for English speakers to somehow think that English is the real language and everything else is a translation. But of course, that's not the way the world works. And so Wikipedia is independently written in all the different languages. And so the question is, how does the content differ? People from different cultures, different languages, they may have different ideas. And I'm happy to report that actually the content is very, very similar. The tone, the style, the way people present things is very similar across all cultures. There's a few reasons for this. One, I always say, is that there's a certain geek culture which transcends national culture. So Wikipedia is very, very good at Star Trek and Star Wars in every language around the world. But the other reason is that in all around the world, people do get the idea of neutrality. They get the style of Wikipedia that we really try to be factual, neutral, avoid inflammatory language, look for reliable sources and lean on the reliable sources and things like that. And that does tend to bring a certain amount of consistency. Now, I'm not saying it's 100% consistent. You will clearly find topics that are highly controversial between two cultures, and the way they present that information can be significantly different. But often what happens there is that someone who speaks both languages will go in and say, actually, look, we've got this real conflict, and it's presented completely differently in the two languages, and we really should try to harmonize to some extent. And those are difficult conversations, but those conversations do take place, and it's really helpful. One of the examples that made me really happy is a couple of years ago, 3 years ago now, I've lost track of the calendar, but when the Iranian elections were held, and there were riots and the opposition was protesting and so on and so forth. And it was quite a period of unrest there. There was a famous case of a young girl who was killed in the street, became quite a cause, et cetera, et cetera. And I was curious to know, I went and read the article in English, which was quite good, and I was curious to know what did the Farsi article say, the language of Iran. And so a friend of mine who is native from birth, essentially, of both English and Farsi. So she's a very, very good speaker of both. I asked her if she would translate for me the Farsi one into English so that I could compare the two. And of course she said, well, translating is difficult. It's really hard to match certain words and to translate the tone and so forth. But, she said, it was actually easier than most things because the Farsi article was written in that very dry, straightforward Wikipedia style. Not a lot of poetic language, not a lot of slang terms, very direct language, and therefore easier to translate. And in terms of the content was very, very similar to the English version. A good bit shorter, simply because the English Wikipedia is the largest and there were lots and lots of people working on it. It was a famous world event. But in terms of the tone and the style and the basic content, it was the same. It said, there was an election that was held, and then the opposition said this, and then there was some unrest, and da-da-da-da. And it did not read like, I mean, what would be your fear? Your fear might be it's being controlled by government agents or, sort of extremists of some kind, whether, extremists in support of the leadership there, or what I thought would be more likely, controlled by young democracy activists who would be using it as a platform to foam it. No, it was neither of those things. It was just the facts. And that, I think, is quite important, particularly in places around the world where the media that people have access to is often highly biased in one direction. Or, frankly, in a place like the United States where the media we have access to is highly polarizing. It's not like we don't have access to a diversity of opinion, but unfortunately, particularly with television, you do tend to get quite biased reports on one side or the other. And so I think it's quite interesting that Wikipedia is serving that purpose of being a common ground, a place for people to come together and try to reach some kind of neutrality, some kind of compromise. I don't mean to imply that it's perfect. Obviously, this is very, very hard to do. People get their feelings hurt, people get angry, but in general, the community has quite a spirit of really trying hard to do this. Now, the content being very similar is one thing, but the readership is actually different. What are people most interested in reading? And we did this little study to look at several languages to see what is the most popular content across a lot of different languages. So this is English, Chinese, Japanese, French, German, Russian, and Spanish. And these are categories. I know it might be a little hard to read there, but I'll point to you. So if you look at Japanese, the big green bar, pop culture. And so if you know anything about Japan, this actually makes sense. The Japanese are really into pop culture. They're into English pop culture, American pop culture, Japanese pop culture. It's a big part of Japanese life, Japanese culture. So to me, this was not at all surprising. It's completely normal that we know the Japanese are really into various aspects of pop culture. Another one to look at is that the Germans are the most interested in geography. I'm just saying. I don't make that joke when I'm in Germany. They're still a little sensitive about that. And then finally, of course, everybody knows that sex is a popular topic on the internet. People are very interested in sexual issues, sexual topics. And so we see that sex is among the top categories in all the languages except for French and Spanish. I was a bit puzzled by this. Until someone explained it to me, it's that the French and the Spanish are actually having sex. And the rest of us are just reading about it on the internet. So this is all very amusing, and we do see that there are differences in the readership and the kinds of things that people are interested in. But actually, when you dig a little bit deeper, some of the differences that you see at a more detailed level actually represent more similarities than differences. So just out of curiosity, how many people in this room could tell me who is Nick Clegg? A few, right? Perfectly normal. There's no shame in this. He is the deputy prime minister in the United Kingdom. If I asked you who is Joe Biden and you didn't know, that would be shameful. But it's fine. So if we go to the Nick Clegg entry and we look at the geographic distribution, who's reading about Nick Clegg, it's mainly people in the UK. Because as the Deputy Prime Minister, he is not going to be able to get his people reading about Dan Campbell too, but he's been doing quite well globally. But you would see
Christian walks. Some of them, who is the, I'll make a quick question, this is the monk of Christian. I'm just excited. Who is the intended governor of the church? Anthony Jesus. I think you're only the only one to believe in Christian talk. I don't know.
I've been in there for like 24 hours. So,
well, we agree on everything primarily with people who are sexist and promise people in there. But that does not represent the difference. That actually is similar. People read about their local politicians and what's quite natural that when you look at sort of not as famous politicians in an anti-Western world, we have about 490 million people using the website every month. The last one I was 491, my second meeting, usually in the fall, we have quite a lot of service. When universities are back in session, people come back to school, and although that's a bit smaller in overall basis than it used to be, simply because there was a time when the college student market was really poor for people, but not even using the TV, so we still see a lot of times pronounced. But I expect that we will see with the number of 500 million, and we actually think it's probably about it. That's one of the things we know is that we have dramatic increase in mobile access and consort sort of great job of tracking mobile access. So they're fixing that, they're actually in parts of mobile access. Also, they really well in India and China, consort business models is they are capturing data from big websites for advertising purposes, for advertising, for websites and so on. And obviously, your advertising market is the most developed in the U.S. So, of course, you're going to reach a lot of your China and India and Africa. But in the internet for the moment, we need to look for a lot of time. We need to focus on some numbers. It's expected enough. Maybe 500 million people are using Wikipedia every month. Why do we want to know who we're competing there? This is a quote someone from a former brother, which he said, yesterday I asked one of my students that he knew what was up to me, and he said, is it something like Wikipedia? So this is a former brother, and if you think about who is in that people to think about the student who is 15 years old, now this one is older than 15, but not in the early time. So for 15 years students, Wikipedia was founded 11 years ago. So when that student was 4 years old, 4 or 5 years old. So we had 4 or 5 years old, that's when we first learned to read. So the first one was a video, and it didn't already exist, and I'm just 4 or 5 years old from Wikipedia, but it existed. And certainly about 110, 5 years ago, Wikipedia was already used and ubiquitous. And so for that student who was now 15, they literally can't remember a time when Wikipedia wasn't a place where you went to get information. They have no idea what happened that whatsoever. And they say, I mean, if you really need to meet them, it's probably 10 years ago. Probably Wikipedia might have used it at home. So for that next generation, I want to talk to you. Wikipedia is just part of the phone that we see. What we do, we need to use the machine to Wikipedia. And so we can really catch who's from Wikipedia. It's about the quality of Wikipedia. It's hard to make the trust under it. So, item number two is roughly 50%. So, our community is about 87% ready. This is not good. It's something that we're really security concern. We're doing a lot of things to try to address this problem. We've been trying to more deeply understand what is the nature of that problem. So, there's several different factors that we know as well. The first one that I'll talk about now is you have to be very, very careful how I'm saying this. I'm not saying girls are not good at computers. Absolutely not saying that. What I'm saying is that the fact that when you click on it, particularly when you look at the page, and you look at the wiki text, and all these complicated editing codes, a lot of speaking for myself, but my father, who was the amateur expert on the 1967 muscle cars, the old Corvettes and things like that, he's not going to do anything. He's going to look at that and he's going to find one of those codes on there. And he's being on the first one, first of all, and he's breaking things, so this is not going to be, it's too complicated. So the fact that we see anything too complicated as a senior puts a lot of people off of computer, and that filter only lets through people who are computer geeks. And computer geeks are overwhelmingly male, and so it's not the only thing that computer geeks are. Most of us are just, most of us are not only learning a wiki markup language to be able to add some information. And as a result, we lose a lot of potential contributors to technology pieces. And then just potential contributors from a lot of other categories, including me, including older people, and so on. We can be able to use about 26, but I don't think it's from the I think we get older on the phone, but it's a particular phone that I think about double the percentage of PhDs compared to the sort of software. But that doesn't mean that we need most of the PhDs, but it means there's a lot more PhDs in our community than you would expect from people in the street. So it's a pretty easy community. There are a lot of reasons why we care about the diversity of the community. One of the reasons is we see some systemic biases in content that we really respond to, for example, our children. A good example is if you go and look at list of award-winning fiction authors, and you look at the male ones versus female ones, we can have much more comprehensive entries on the male ones than the female ones. And one of the reasons is that a lot of the female award-winning authors are writing chick lit kind of books that a lot of men just don't want to read, and our male community, you know, they're reading their eyes, so they don't want to read. That's a problem. We want to have all kinds of information from all kinds of people, so we really want to get a lot more people involved. So now I'm going to show you a quick video to introduce you to some of these things. So then interactive events, it's very good when you think of Wikipedia, Wikipedia is an institution, it's a website, and then it's hard to always remember a few about the people behind who actually created this for it. So, we have this video. That's strange. But we can give you a label, which I will pump in now. So, I hope it's still in there. So, we'll get to the video. One day we learned some of the things about the whole Wikipedia phenomenon is that we are a non-profit organization. So we are 5C3, which means that we don't have to take it off any taxes. We subsist primarily from donations from different parts of the small donors are the backbone of the funding that we get. We get some money from larger charitable grants, from foundations and things like that, but the bulk of the money is the small donors, and that's been very important to us. And the Wikimedia Foundation is actually quite small. It's just over 100 employees, and we have over 100,000 volunteers, depending on how you measure volunteers, but all people that write everything you see in the next stuff. You go to the front page of Wikipedia and see the news of the day, and this and that, and the speaker, all of that is created by volunteers. So the staff, the members, has nothing to do with almost anything related to editorial policy or the website. And the staff is involved in keeping the website running. So we've got programs, improving software, we've got ops people keeping servers running, we've got, county finance, we've got legal, we've got communications, we've got different staff members doing different parts of making sure that the organization is running well. They don't really have anything to do with what you see on the website, and that's completely remarkable. So, what that I'll start talking about next year is the video that you're going to have next week. So, this is the Wikipedia volunteers.
Why are you not going to be able to do that?
Plagiarism. This is really, really important. It's important for a couple of reasons. One, we want people to be able to take the content and reuse it. We want them to be able to take it and redistribute it to anyone they want to for free. And we don't want them to get into legal trouble if they do that. So being within the law is very important to protect the integrity of YouTube. But there's something else beyond just following the law, and that is the moral side of things. One of the things that our community is very, very proud of is we made this ourselves. We actually did all this stuff ourselves. So however good or bad Wikipedia may be, nobody's ever going to say, oh, yeah, Wikipedia is great. That's because they copied it all from somewhere. We really don't like that. We're quite proud that we made it ourselves and gave it as a gift to the world. Stability. So we have certain rules like no personal attacks. The idea is that when you are coming to Wikipedia and you're going to participate, it should be a civil conversation. You shouldn't be insulted, you shouldn't be yelled at. Now, obviously, we're human beings, and so people do get upset, fights break out. If somebody calls somebody a name, they don't get banned immediately, they apologize and things like that. It's quite a normal sort of student environment, and what we try to say is, look, if you're going to come in and be a dick day in, day out, eventually the community can invite you to leave. And they say, look, you just keep insulting everyone, treating people badly. You're really not welcome. We're trying to write something here. We're trying to build something for the future. And then finally, one of the most surprising rules of Wikipedia is to IRL, the moral rules. What this means is that there are no firm rules in Wikipedia that basically, if something needs to be done, to make Encyclopedia better, you could be bold. You could just make that change, and hopefully you'll protect your people and people see the light, and then some little editorial policy somewhere will change. But this is also, one of the early versions of this. It's basically, if rules make you nervous and depressed, just ignore them. Part of it is check on the community. It says, we couldn't have rules that you couldn't just get about it for 5 seconds. The rule should be normal. So to say, you can't go in and call people Nazis with them, we shouldn't have to have rules for that. And if you're a normal, nice person, you don't need to go and read 100 rules of behavior to tell you how to. It's all basically kindergarten ethics. It's stuff that you should learn when you're 5 years old. And you should apply everything. It shouldn't apply, for example, formatting, the proper formatting of a reference in Wikipedia. You should be able to just go in and add a reference. Just add a link that's a reference, and it's not formatted correctly. No one will yell at you. Well, if you yell at you, that means like, they'll tell them, hey, no, you don't want to be incorrectly formatted references. But it's a picture for you. Like, if somebody's so obsessive that they have to have the references in a certain format, they should just fix it for you. and not guilty because we're happy to have you participating in all these references. So how does the community start to work? This is one of the sort of the interesting elements of the whole project as well. So the first thing to know, Wikipedia is not an anarchy. A lot of people have the idea of Wikipedia that it's, you know, 100 million people each having one simple page to somehow their office creates a tons of encyclopedia. This is the kind of thinking that that crowdsourcing firm gets people to. But as I said before, it's really about rules participating. It's about a community, meaning people who actually know each other and discuss things. And so it's not a complete anarchy. We do have rules. And we make decisions, and it's a complicated sort of stuff, but one of the structures is consensus. This says, when you're editing a Wikipedia entry, we discourage people from voting. We say, yes, what we really want to do is keep rewriting until everyone kind of works. And the reason for this is that if you're writing an entry and you look around the room, if we had a rule that we're going to vote on the best word term, you look around the room and into the room, virtual room, and you see you've got about 70% support. You're likely to dig in your heels and call for a vote because you know you're going to win the vote. But if 30% of these Wikipedians, of thoughtful the people, still disagree, there's almost always a better way. There's almost always something that you could do that would make everyone agree actually this is an improvement. So we really try not to vote. However, we do have some elements of democracy, some voting. Sometimes there is an either or question, and there is no obvious compromise. But for example, if you're talking about the article on the actual title, I think everyone will agree that here's the article, and right up there in the upper right, there could be a picture of the Eiffel Tower, but we might have a few legitimate candidates for which picture to use. And you can't sort of merge the pictures, there's no way to rewrite them. And so you kind of pick one. So then oftentimes we'll hold a little straw poll. But even that is not binding, it's more of a way of making decisions. Because most people say, I think picture B is better than picture A. But if I see a poll and I see that 90% of people disagree with me, probably I'm a sensible, normal person, I'm just going to drop them. I'm going to go, okay, well, I can't convince people, so I'm just checking it over. People are very hard on getting over things like that, but generally do. There's a little bit of real autocracy, and so what this means is that there are people in the community, very thoughtful, very kind, experienced Wikipedians who are widely respected, who do have more authority, who do have the ability to do things that others don't. Some of that is social, some of that is actually in software. We have administrators who are elected by community, and then a little bit of democracy. The administrators have certain powers that others don't. And that is part of how we function. And then finally, we have a little bit of monarchy, which is my role in the community. And like any good modern monarchy, it really means by wave of parade and peace ceremonial act. It does not mean I am the dictator of all human knowledge. I am not. I don't want to be. So, what this does mean, though, is that I do have certain powers within the community, particularly the English Wikipedia community, that are mainly there so that we can change the rules and fund it the way that we need to. So, if the community, right now, there's no obvious way to change the community for rules. If people really thought we needed to, then I would step forward and put forward a structure, and we would have a big dialogue around that. It's kind of an escape path. It's checks and balances. We want to make sure that we don't fit into any corner groups. There's one example that's been going on lately is the number of people who are elected administrator has declined precipitously. Almost no one gets elected administrator in the last 3 or 4 months. It's been very, very bad, and most people agree the process is broken. It's become too hard to become an administrator. Something needs to be done about it, but there's like a bunch of proposals about what to do about it, and there's no means right now of choosing between them. So this is a case where I'm not going to step in. But I'm not going to step in and say, here's the new process for administrators, because people are involved and they're making a good modern team. I know that if I try to make people do stuff, they'll just be happy and I'll be doing that. Instead, I'll look forward a proposal to the process and we'll have people vote, and there won't be consensus. We're not going to get the consensus around the change in how administrators are elected. We're going to have an election, and whichever one wins by 51% is going to be the new way. And that's quite the need for Wikipedia, but that's kind of part of the touch we have. So that we can get ourselves out of some solutions and find a way forward.
So now I'm going to switch gears and we'll talk about something completely different. I'm really going to talk about how Wikipedia works and what I'm doing from a Wikipedia perspective. But now I'm going to talk about Wikipedia in the developing world. Because I think this is one of the most fundamental things that's going on. And I'm not going to just talk about Wikipedia in the developing world, but also the internet more broadly. And one of the reasons I like to talk about this is that lots and lots of people have some idea about it, but they don't really know what's going on. So here's what most people know. If I go somewhere and I'm at a cocktail party or something like that, it's really exciting what's going on with mobile phones and internet and access. And inevitably, someone will say, ooh, 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 I know. I've heard about this. So this is finally in text across town and find the butterfly for the crops. And they to walk and deliver their crops, and now they can go to the higher price and money. And that is absolutely true. There's been lots of research about that sort of thing. It's true enough, but it's quite the mind. This is the view of what's going on in Africa. You're missing the picture. And so this kind of image, this kind of concept, I think we need to step back from that and go, actually, that's kind of interesting, but it's a bit outdated and it's not as interesting as what's really going on. So what you probably don't know, and I usually, I think I'm trying to know because I've got my American phone, but this is my phone. That's not actually my Christian phone, that's a copy type of photo. My phone, that's my name. This is a phone. A friend of mine bought this phone for me in Finland. He bought it on the case. It's an unlocked phone, so you stick it in the phone, I never use it. I use it every day at home in England, wherever. And it is a Google phone, Android phone. Screen is not as good as your iPhone. It's smaller. You know, sometimes the screen's a little finicky. Not as finicky as this phone, it's horrible. I don't even know which brand it is because I've been quoting it, but it's a good phone, isn't it? One of the amazing things about it is the battery will last 15 days, but you can say that. So it's a small little Android phone, perfectly usable, 3G, reasonable fast, and it costs $50. And they have sold hundreds of thousands of these in Kenya already. And he bought it from me last year, it was $85. I just saw him a couple weeks ago. And he said, oh, yeah, that phone that was $85, now it's $50. So amazing, $50 phone, hundreds of thousands of people with real internet access. That's in Kenya. Let's look at another country, Nigeria. Internet usage in Nigeria. In 2000, 0.1% of the country was online. By 2006, 3.1%. 2009, 16.1%. 2011, look at this thing, 29%. And I think when the 2012 numbers come out, then you're looking at 35%. This is the kind of surge that we saw in the U.S. that led to the dot-com boom. This is the kind of thing that we all understood 10 years ago, and this is happening now in Nigeria. But how fast? What does the bandwidth look like? So bandwidth, you know, is how to measure how fast the connection is. In January of 2002, the bandwidth to the entire country of Nigeria was 72 megabits per second. Now, what's interesting about this, I just got, and I'm not here to advertise this service, I'm just astonished by it. I just got Verizon Fios at home in Florida. I have a place in Florida. My Verizon Fios connection, I get reliably 150 megabits download speed. I mean, it's just astonishing. I'm astonished by it. I'm super excited about it, but it's really super exciting to think about. At home, I have twice as much bandwidth as the entire country of Nigeria has just 10 years ago. And that's amazing. By January, it was 7,693 megabits. And by the end of this year, they keep dropping figures in 12,000 megabits. And so the ramping up, they're dropping fiber optic cables from Europe. One of the drop points is largely Nigeria. There's other drop points. People run down the coast. There's drop points along the way. This is amazing. So what is this leading to? So what it's leading to is coming to consumers there a little slower than we might hope. But the broadband, the backbone wholesale price of data transfer is collapsing. It's coming down very, very quickly. And in the city, people are beginning to have reasonable speed for internet. I was there in one of those countries a few months ago. I tested my internet on speed test and I got 9.33 down. I asked my friend in New York at the same time to test the connection, 8.3. So the internet in Nigeria is faster than in New York City. When I tweeted this, a lot of people from Nigeria, a lot of Nigerians locally said,
this is completely false. This is ridiculous. The government is lying to you or tricking you or something like that. It wasn't false. But there is a valid point there. I was doing the conference and they put me in the Fancy Hotel. So I'm in the Fancy Hotel with a really good internet connection in the city. So that does not represent the, you know, don't come away from thinking that people in Davos have a better internet connection than you do. That is not what's true. The point is, real, usable internet is coming very fast. What are people doing, right? Are they searching for prices and products? Are they recording the layout? That's the other one that people say. But other things, once they get the internet, they can report the layout to the government. But yeah, I mean, I suppose they could do. I'm always reporting food robberies to the government. But what do people do? They get online. Once they start having real, usable internet access, the top five protesters are Google, Facebook, Twitter, Wikipedia, local newspaper. When you look at what people do when they get online, these are people who, you know, people for whom getting that $50 mobile phone is quite an investment. You know, the phone was cost $500 years ago. They couldn't afford it. Now they can afford a mobile phone with good internet access. What do they do? They do all the same normal things that we do. And I think that is my big message here, is that when you think about what is going to happen with mobile and access, we have all this descriptive farm you're thinking, yes, that stuff is going on, it's interesting stuff, but there's something much more powerful, much bigger going on, which is ongoing market technology, making real and usable internet access available to millions of people across Africa today. And if you think for 20 years, we're going to have massive connectivity to the real internet for hundreds of millions of people. And now if you think beyond, we're seeing stories from here, people in lots of countries around the world, lots of poor countries that have had bad internet access in the past, therefore few people online, few people active. And these people in Africa, I would say, do not speak English or French. Even in India, there was a time a few years ago, you know, I was in India and a young student in India came up to me and said, I don't really understand why you're so concerned about all the local languages in India, because everybody in India with a computer speaks English, so that's the point. And maybe 5 minutes ago that was true, but if you look at the numbers, in India, about 43 million people speak English. And that's the best estimate that I've seen. And there's like another 900 million people who don't speak English at all. And guess what? They're coming on the internet. They're getting online in massive numbers. And so therefore, these local languages really matter. The impact this is going to have is really, it's unpredictable, but I think it's a challenge. When I stand up here and I say Gangnam Style, and everybody were in last, and we've all seen the video, just think about that. It's a South Korean pop music video that everybody in this room has seen. And if you haven't, you know, don't. I also love it. I've watched it like 50 times, but like seriously, don't. You'll do that right thing a lot of your life. That's the tip of the iceberg. You know, what music videos are going to come out of Nigeria? Everybody's heard of Bollywood movies, but, you know, there's a whole huge Nigerian film industry. We're going to start hearing about that, we're going to start seeing these things. The cultural impact of people coming online and interacting for the first time is going to be phenomenal, and it's really, really hard to predict or understand what's going to happen. So, that's basically my prepared remarks. I actually have a few more slides that I'm going to skip over to the right of the question on the future part, because this is about the key in my 400 company. If I were a good businessman, I'd stand here and pitch it to you, but I'm depressed. Actually, Lost TV is quite amazing. How many people know the TV for Lost? How many of you actually understood it? There's one guy. He probably edits Lostpedia. So Lostpedia is the key in my 400 company. We allow people to create a wiki community about anything. Mainly gaming, pop culture, lifestyle. Unlike Wikipedia, where everybody's concerned about having a source, as a peer, they allow original research, they allow theorizing. So it's really great for a TV show like Lost, where you're not going to find academic sources for what's probably the next book for. You have to watch it in real time. So they're much more capable of that. And what was interesting about Lost and Wikipedia is, I met J.J. Abrams, who is the creator. And he said, oh, yeah, we love Lost TV, we use it all the time. And
So there was this guy, and this is a quote from a magazine article. The writer of the show was pumped. They were looking to make a reference to Canada, except no one was exactly sure how they had done it in the past. So what did they do? They looked it up in Lostpedia. They used it a lot. So I'm going to go back for the answer on this. Does anybody know what it is about Lost in Canada? It's that every time someone in the show mentions Canada, they run. And that happened many, many times in the show. And I believe, although I've not quite confirmed it, that was an accident at first. It happened 3 or 4 times. Which, by the way, most of the characters in Lost are lying all the time. So, as far as I could tell. But the writers had seen that in Lostpedia and decided to write it into the show. And so that kind of interesting things. Other things that they did were things like they would read Lostpedia and they would see the fans theorizing. And sometimes they would know the hints are wrong, but we're going to feed them that. We're going to throw a little more hints in that direction to lead them a little further down the path. Or they said, no, actually, don't want anything like that. So the next available episode, we'll teach you about theories and we can cut off that line of speculation. And so the writing of the show became, in a way, a collaboration between the writing staff and the fans. And they would take into account what the fans thought, what they understood, and it helped lead the path of the show forward. Really very interesting stuff. 7 million people. I'm just going to show you one more video, and then we're going to
you just added your own contribution to Wikipedia.
I read an article in The Guardian about the online encyclopedia which everybody can contribute to, and I thought, well, maybe I can contribute to as well.
I edited it the first time, and I think I wrote for this picture. I didn't think it was good movie. I did do it for something that the movie must be done by.
You may start doing it for an idea because you believe in it, but you end up with tennis, you end up with rubbers, you end up with wonderful discussions, you end up with new ideas, you end up with the new books you're going to write. You're not writing the article alone. You write a piece and somebody else says, like, hey, I have more, and together you can create articles that are pretty strong, which is fun. Writing like the other thing, okay, well, I kind of want to see it,
and this is it.
When I read about Wikipedia, I decided that this is maybe where I would fit in. And I just.
Yeah. Thank you.
At this point in time, if you have a question for Mr. Wales, if you could line up behind one of the two microphones here, and he will take your questions. Thank you so much.
This microphone is very unpopular. The Wikipedia community is 87% male, but this audience is not. And this always happens. All the boys jump up and run to the front, knocking down all the girls on the way. So I would like to invite particularly any women in the audience to come up and ask a question as well, because this is ridiculous. Boys? Yes.
Mr. Wales, first I'd like to say thank you again.
Mr. Wales is my father. I'm not that old. Actually, I am that old, but okay. Yeah.
My question really pertains to the beginning and the origin of your company. When there was really only a handful of people working on Wikipedia, how did you first start setting up the bulk of the articles that would attract the bigger audience?
So there's a few elements to that. So before Wikipedia, there was a project called Newpedia, which was an effort to, same end goal, but we didn't understand about online communities very well. We didn't even know about the concept of Wiki at that time. This was about 2 years before founding Wikipedia. But we had a good community. A lot of people were really excited by the vision, by the idea. And so for about 2 years, there's a large group of people. We spent about 2 years struggling with bad software, struggling with the bad design of the system, but talking about creating an encyclopedia and thinking about what it would mean to create an encyclopedia. Such that when I installed the Wiki software in Type Color World and had the Wiki going, there was a rush of people who were ready to contribute and came and began working on it. In the early days, I did things like I did this by hand. I would go through the server log and look at what were we getting the most traffic from Google for. And I would make a page called What Google Loves, on the site for the site. And if I did a look at it, say, this is the kind of stuff that people seem to be interested in, so why don't we make more like that? And we would do things like, World War II history, always a popular topic, so, things like that. So the community would be very eager to say, okay, yeah, let's write, things that people want to read, because it's no fun to write something no one's going to read. So a lot of things like that, but it was really, in the early days, our traffic started doubling about every 3 months from the beginning, from that initial flurry, it was kept growing and growing and growing. It was still kind of small, it's only after about the 6th or 7th doubling when you start to go, oh my God, it's huge, right? So it was really that we had a very passionate community early on who just wanted to build something that people would enjoy.
Okay. We talked a lot about the really great future directions that you see Wikipedia going. Wondering what you thought the biggest challenges that Wikipedia is facing long term and what you're doing to address them.
So one of the challenges that I alluded to, which is I do think that we have a problem with community diversity, and that leads to a lot of other problems. One of the things you may read about sometimes is that the number of people contributing to Wikipedia has declined. What you'll often read that it is in decline. I don't think that's true. It's been stable for about 2 years, but it has declined from the peak. And I don't think that's a problem. I think part of the reason for that, probably the most important reason, is that it's harder and harder to find something to write about that isn't already very, very good in Wikipedia. So there's not that sort of aha moment when you click on something and you go, oh, wow, there's nothing here. I know a little bit. I can start contributing. My favorite example is I grew up in Alabama. George Wallace, a very controversial politician, was governor of Alabama for most of the time I was growing up. And I live in England. I was telling somebody about George Wallace and his career. And I thought, I'll go look at the Wikipedia entry, and I got excited, ooh, George Wallace, I haven't thought about him in many years, and I read the article, and at the end, I'm like, wow, that was really good. I couldn't possibly help with this article. I know nothing that's not in the article. And so I didn't contribute. So some of that I'm not too worried about, but we do have a concern. I think everybody's got a concern. If the community dwindles away and it ends up getting Wikipedia, that's going to be a very bad thing. So that's, I think, the challenge is that we face. Okay.
I just want to say thank you, Helen. I'm really, really, really glad you're here. And I have two sort of short questions. They're not really just kind of random facts that apply to find Wikipedia, but why do you live in England? And at what point did you realize that Wikipedia was going to be like, one of these sort of internet giants, that it was going to be this incredible project? At what point did you go from like Wikipedia? I made Wikipedia, and then I think that you realize that it could really be a massively collaborative project.
Yeah. So, there's a few reasons I live in England. Most importantly, I just got married to an English girl, and I moved there. She has a very important job, and she was running communications for the torch relay of the Olympics. So that was pretty exciting. The job had said she didn't want to move because she just met me. I loved her. So, also, because my work is very, really global, I work with people all around the planet, but it turns out the population is not distributed evenly around the planet. It's about 8 time zones. It's 8 time zones to California. It's about 8 time zones to Hong Kong. And then past that, it's the Pacific Ocean. So discriminating against people who live in Hawaii, but pretty much have that population covered. So it's a good place for international work. And, when did I know it's going to be this? I'm not sure, really, because it was doubling every 3 months, and that kind of creeps up on you. We were so busy for a long time just scrambling to buy and install servers that there was no one moment when I'm like, oh my, this is going to be big. There were a lot of moments where it's like, why not? One of the moments that was interesting is that there was our first big Wikipedia scandal, so to speak. we had a really serious error in Wikipedia that got in there and lasted for 4 months. About a wonderful senior journalist, John Steenbell, and he found the error and he called me. He's old school, you know, so he picked up the phone and called me. We had fixed within 10 minutes, but I hadn't known about it before. Nobody had seen it. I didn't say nobody had seen it, but it wasn't linked to other places. And then he wrote this screaming editorial in the USA Today calling us dangerous and irresponsible, which surprised me because he was very nice on the phone. And all of a sudden, we're in the press everywhere. They called me on CNN to yell at me. And I thought it's tripled in about a month. So, okay, well, I don't really want to grow in that way, but it didn't really actually hurt. So that was one moment when it was like, well, you know, really, if CNN cares what we're doing, obviously this has had an impact, and it was one of the first times that we really realized, like, people know about it.
So I have a couple of questions. My first question, so I'll ask my second question then. I'm not sure, but from my understanding, I've heard that Wikipedia uses scanners or programs that scan through the Wikipedia articles and basically like search for accuracy and whatnot. I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit, or first of all, clarify if that's true, and then if so, like what do they search for with their
So there are a lot of different bots running. None, as far as I know, are run by the Wikimedia Foundation. So it's ordinary geeks who've created software to do all kinds of interesting things. One of the simplest kinds would be spell checking. But of course, computers can be spell checking, but not perfectly. So generally, they flag the possibilities in it, and a human sits there and says yes or no. To fix it, which is quite a tedious and boring task. Some people enjoy it, like missing or something. They do it, probably obsessively. There are anti-vandalism bots that look for telltale characteristics of vandalism. I don't know if they publish all the secrets of how to detect vandalism, but some of them are fairly obvious. So if you see an article and it goes from 20,000 characters to the word fuck, probably that's not a legitimate edge. And in fact, most of them, so curse words, for example, there's no rules against curse words on Wikipedia. They can often be an important part of the historical record. Or, there are reasons why we have curse words on Wikipedia. Well, however, 99% of the time, if an article suddenly has a curse word in it, it's probably vandalism. So those get flagged for humans to look at. So there's a lot of little things like that that people do. Okay, let's reorder here. I'm taking one at a time. I'm going to take a question from the back. So I see, actually, she's here, so I want the two ladies to come to the front. I want the ladies to come to the front over here. Yeah, there you go.
Hi.
No, I do think it's interesting because it is universal every place in the world. The men are much better at jumping up and running to the microphone. And I don't know why, but so. I'm proactive about
this. Okay. Hi. Can you talk a bit more about the reason you can do a blackout for anti-SOPA? And I'm just wondering, I read that, the awareness increased and it's available on the mobile platform and on the web. And what you learned from that experience?
Yeah. So, quite famously, earlier this year, we made a big protest against SOPA and FIPA, which is basically the same law, but it was the House and Senate versions. So the story of that is back in December, I started to get word about these two bills and they were quite alarming. And it's Stop Online Piracy Act. And the thing is, what's really important to us, but one of my concerns is, I would like to stop online piracy. I don't think that's an illegitimate goal. I'm not an extremist about that. However, stopping online piracy by setting up a Chinese-style blocking system that forces ISPs to block overseas websites without court hearing and so on is just wrong. It's not the right answer. And so we were very concerned about it, but even more we were concerned about the way it was being pushed through. There had been one hearing, and the only representative from the internet was Google. We agreed with Google on this issue, but Google was there and basically was getting yelled at about piracy on YouTube and things like this. And we thought, you know, it doesn't really represent the internet community. One of the things this was getting framed as a debate between sort of Silicon Valley versus Hollywood was an industrial dispute, who's going to make money out of this. And we felt like it was a free speech issue, and it was an issue for the users of the internet, and so we felt like we were in a position to represent that. So I made a suggestion to the Wikipedia community saying, just come on the Wikipedia page, maybe we should go on strike. I'm not sure, what do you think? Because a few months before, the Italians had gone on strike, because there was a law by the Berlusconi government that was going to a censorship law in Italy, and the Italian Wikipedians decided to black out for the day. And well, when I first heard about this, I thought, wow, well, I thought, well, they're Italians, so you know, go on strike. In fact, they were very successful. That law, the next day, you know, as soon as they did this, Parliament dropped it immediately. So they were victorious. Well, I thought maybe we could do the same thing. And I thought, so we had a big vote in the community, overwhelming support to do this. So we blacked out for the day. We had a tool people could contact their Congress people. And it was a massive, massive success. I mean, it was unprecedented. One senator said that 10 million people contacted, 10 million voters contacted Congress that day. We had reports that the House of Representatives' phone system crashed because so many people were calling, and they dropped it immediately. The head of the RIAA, the Movie Industry Group, put out a very angry statement saying that our actions were an abuse of power. And I said, 10 million voters calling Congress is not an abuse of power, it's called democracy. And it was for the first time, I think Congress got the message that the general public actually does care about fairly arcane issues relating to copyright and openness on the internet, because it affects them in lots of ways. And in the past, copyright, of course, is really an industrial regulation. It's about what the big publishers do, how do they make money, and not what other publishers do things. Now copyright affects all of us. We all, you know, want to publish things online, and there's a lot of things that need reforming. I mean, just my favorite, this is not about soap or whatever, I applaud it, but I think we should do maybe two more. I don't know when we're coming off the stage, but the thing is, if you go to a children's birthday party and you're filming the kids having fun, right? And in the background there's some pop music playing, and you stick it on YouTube as one does, right? And you want to note that YouTube may, and they've done this in cases, they get an automated complaint from a robot that's found the song in there, and they blank out the soundtrack. It's ridiculous. This is a kid's birthday party. And the law doesn't fully recognize and defend that kind of use. And there's lots of things like that. But ordinary people are just trying to use media in normal ways. And it's time to update a lot of the laws. And it's time to update them with input from not just the movie industry and the music industry. Because they always want more draconian penalties and so on. That's not working. So anyway, it's fun. It's good. Now, where I think it's helpful on that is that they're not going to do things without at least consulting more broadly with the internet community. And I think that is a major win-win. I live in England, so it's quite easy. But quite often, I was just there last week, and I met with the Home Secretary, who's putting forward the Snoopers Charter to basically spy on everybody's internet connection. And in the past, they would not have thought to call me in to tell them what's wrong with it. I got a chance to go in and I explained what's wrong with it. Not sure they listened, but, you know, at least we're having a dialogue. And they do respect that, you know, the opinion of people using the internet actually matters. So that's really important. Go on.
It's really interesting for Wikipedia model as a possible way to organize society.
So is the Wikipedia model a possible way to organize society? Well, yes and no. I think there are a lot of lessons from Wikipedia about self-organizing groups of people, but I don't think we can turn all governments into wiki, and let people just debate on the wiki. But I do think, I mean, for me, I think the key social message around governance and society from Wikipedia is, when you look at how massively popular Wikipedia is, how many people turn to Wikipedia, I believe because it does represent a more
neutral approach to information. Lots of times people, they get really sick of, you turn on CNN or Fox News and you see basically, you know, their idea of neutrality is you stick two people up on the screen who yell at each other, and there's a lot of sort of slamming of the phone. People just, they're like, I just want basic information. And look at people's incredible utility popular. And so I do think there is great hope in this, that with the passing of the formula media, that I'm hoping some media owners begin to realize, actually, people are a bit disgusted by the media being so biased and aggressive all the time. And instead, they should try to go back to a, you know, calmer reporting style. Yes. And our last question of the evening.
I think it's pretty easy to see how things from the developing the developed world have sort of showed up in the internet use of people who are just getting on the internet for the first time, mm-hmm. like in these countries that are just coming online now. But I was wondering if you've seen anything from these developed countries that has gone the other way.
So from the developing world to the developed world. Not a lot yet, but I think that's natural. But I mean, one of the exciting things, Nigeria is a good example. Nigeria has a booming IT industry, and they're really strong, as I understand it, I'm not an expert on it, but they're really strong in app development. And what's interesting is that app development is actually a place in the software world that's a great place for small teams. You know, if you want to compete with Microsoft Excel, right? You're not going to get two programmers together and write something better than Microsoft Excel. It's a huge product, many, many features, it took you years and years to play that. But today, because the apps are all new and everything is sort of exciting, there's a lot of new ideas, you get something like Instagram, which sold Facebook for whatever, over $1 billion, and had, I believe, 13 employees. And you think about that, and you think about when is that going to happen? There's no reason why that couldn't happen in Nigeria, where you get a team of four programmers who create something that they sell for $100 million and then turn around and invest in growing more and more and more. So I do think there's a really exciting opportunity. I also think that people will use the internet differently depending on their local circumstances. And, you know, so one example that I have no idea what's going on here in this area, but getting a taxi. So in San Francisco is Uber. It's massively successful because there's no taxis in San Francisco, so you can get on Uber and get a black, like a Lincoln Town Car from you. They're trying to come into the London market, and I so far completely failing because in London, it's a completely different world. There's the black taxis everywhere. The payloads are calling the black taxis. There's obviously links that didn't cross. It doesn't work. I think that a lot of those kind of businesses will work differently in different places. Same kind of ideas, an app to get a car to get a ride somewhere, but they'll be different. And so a lot of those businesses will be unique and different. And some of those will, innovations will leak over into other areas. And so far, I haven't seen a whole lot, but I haven't really looked for it. But I would say in the next 5 years, I will say without a doubt, in the next 5 years, we'll read some story about, two young kids in Nigeria who are 20 years old who made $1 million with some cool app that lots of people are using. Okay, great, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming. At this time, we'll now have a meet and greet upstairs in the Flipper Room. If anyone wants to meet Jimmy himself, you can head up there, and we will be there in 2 minutes. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks.